Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, our interesting customers pop in to rent something, and we go through the films that they've loved across their life. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. Good morning. Welcome to the video store. Thank you for wandering into our lovely video store here. It's just me behind the counter. My name is Russell. When not working here at the video store, I am the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. And today is a very special episode. Today is one of our guest episodes. Usually on a Tuesday, I am joined behind the counter with fellow clerks, and we talk about the movies and the series that we're watching. But today we are going to have one of our special customers come in. Perhaps there's something that they are returning, which is a film that they've enjoyed recently. But ultimately, we use this as a chance to talk about their work, their career, and what they got going on in their lives. Today is a very special guest. Emily Blichfeldt is popping in to rent something. She is a very exciting, very newly established Norwegian filmmaker whose film The Ugly Stepsister has been screening around the world in festivals and getting the most incredible attention. And for those who don't know, a film festival circuit is really where a film finds its economy and gets itself distributors, gets itself awards. And from that, we had a distributor buy the rights for the screenings to take place in Africa. And so The Bioscope, the cinema that I am the owner of, is a very proud screener of The Ugly Stepsister. It is in cinemas around the country, including The Bioscope, as of right now. So very cool, very exciting horror, and very excited to have Emily pop in a moment. For those who are perhaps discovering us for the first time, welcome. As I said, we do have these regular episodes where we talk more about the TV shows and the films that we're enjoying. But for all those that, you know, wander in every week, I think you're in for a real treat this week because you've got yourself a first-time writer and director. The Ugly Stepsister is Emily's feature debut, and I think she's got an incredible story of how it all came together. We love at the video store showing you how the sausage is made, so to speak. And this episode is a really good one when it comes to how this kind of thing can get done. We know this, that films are very difficult to get out into the world. And she's just also such an incredible voice and creative mind that it's a real honor to get this kind of hour-long, uninterrupted time to chat. So let's waste no more time, and let's get straight into it. I can see here she is. This is Emily Blichfeldt popping in to rent something. Welcome. Welcome to the video store. This is our weekly podcast that we produce out of an independent cinema, which I own here in Johannesburg.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Do you have any connection or any knowledge of South Africa or Johannesburg? That's always a nice place to start.
I went to Cape Town when I was 18. There's a film festival in northern Norway where I'm from, like above the polar circle. There's a film festival for youth called NUF, Nordic Youth Film Festival or something. And they have done these great collabs like with Palestine, with Russia, and with South Africa.
Oh, cool.
So we went to Cape Town to have like a film workshop with South African youth. I think they were mostly from townships, and we made like short films in a week.
That's
and
so cool.
And it was so fun.
And Cape Town's beautiful. Cape Town very presents itself almost a little bit like a supermodel walking into the room. You immediately you can't help but But look, Johannesburg is more that person that you've spent the whole night with, and after the, and at the end of the night you actually fall in love, but you didn't quite notice it in the beginning. It's more the personality and the character of Joburg. And so I need to admit up front that I haven't had the opportunity to watch The Ugly Stepsister because we're
you're in for a treat.
Yeah, we're on the tip of Africa here. We're far away from the festival scene that this film has been in. And there is a incredible boutique distribution agency called What the Hero Wants. And an individual who I spend a lot of time talking with, I've never met him in real life, Ari, was at the Berlin Film Festival.
Yes, I met him there.
Yes, lovely dude. And he said out of all the films that he saw, The Ugly Stepsister just was something special. And it was something different. And they've got the distribution rights for Africa, and so we have our tickets on sale. We start screenings this weekend, and I'm not entirely sure what I'm getting myself into, but all accounts, from what he said and from what I can see, I know this is what we call a bioscope film. We're just a single screen cinema here. We do a lot of stuff with embassies, so we often screen foreign language. We have worked with the Norwegian Film Festival, with the Norwegian Embassy, and we're actually talking to them again, funny enough. And so we've done these kinds of films, and so that's why I'm very excited. So I want to get into what the film's about and how this has all come to be. I'd love to know where you are at right now in your life. And especially because such a big, bold, daring, very detailed, very gory film was pulled off and done by you. And this is your debut feature film, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we're going to get into it. Firstly, where are you right now? You're in Norway?
Right now, I'm in Norway. I'm in Oslo. As I said, above the polar circle, like from far up north where nobody really lives, or we live there, I guess, north regions, but there's not many of us. It's where we have like no sun for 2 months in the winter and all sun for 2 months in the summer.
Well, speaking of film exchange programs and how you came to Cape Town, I was lucky enough in my university here in Johannesburg to be a part of an exchange program where I went to Finland. So I got relatively close.
And relatively close.
Yeah, you'd appreciate this. I remember getting the call and going, "Awesome. I know it's in Europe. I know it's sort of up there." And then getting the call to say, "No, you've been, selected." And I was like, "Great. Let me show someone," because someone said, "Where is it?" And I said, "No, it's here in Europe." And then I was like, "Wait, hold on. And I just kept going further and further up. And I thought, shit, I'm right by the Arctic Circle. I was able to go over Vapu. I don't know how much translates to Norway, but this is their like spring day. So this is the 1st of May. And it's 3 days of everyone drinking in the park. There's babies everywhere because that's what you do in winter, right? Is you make the babies. And I really got a chance to just see how much the seasons meant to people like yourself. In Joburg here, it's starting to get a little chilly, so I'm probably going to put on a little jersey and maybe there's one or two bouts of a cold spell. But for the most part, it's not big. I mean, does that have a huge effect on you, the seasons?
Yes, we're in the middle of the spring here in Norway, and although I'm down south in Oslo now, spring's quite chilly. We have the National Day coming up, the 17th of May, which is a big thing for us, and it can be everything from like bikini weather, which means 20 degrees in Norway. I know it's not bikini weather in South Africa, And then, growing up, it was mostly still snowing in May, so often we in the north, we have winter from October to May.
Okay.
And then we have spring through May, maybe. have some summer, July, August, and then there's the August is actually fall again.
So. The psychology of it is so interesting because I remember being at a house party, and when we left at just after midnight and we were catching the train back to the apartment, it's broad daylight. You know, and
yes, that's insane. That's the insane part in summer, though, you know, when the sun never sets. So when you can actually, if you're by the coast, you can see the sun go towards the horizon, like actually the sea, and then just turn and go up again. And you know, it's so weird to get out of the bar at 3 in the night, and then there's just like this low-hanging sun just like scorching you in your face, you know.
How do you think that affects you as a creative? Do you feel more inspired when the sun is shining, or do you feel more depressed in the winter? How does it affect you?
I moved away from Northern Norway. So in Oslo, there's no midnight sun. There's no all darkness and all of that. So, you know, I say Northern Norway is for the specially interested. You have to be very outdoorsy to enjoy it. And I'm not very outdoorsy. But I guess, you know, growing up there, I grew up very lonely. I grew up in a place with 10 houses, 4 kilometers to the next family with children, and in the school, you know, we were the biggest class, and we were 12 people. Okay. The class under me had one guy.
I would imagine that really helped fuel an imagination, because you wrote and directed this film, so you've got the capacity for the writing. Did storytelling and writing start at this point when you were feeling lonely in your little Norwegian town?
Yeah, I guess, yes. I spent a lot of time with myself and out in great, vast nature. And I was wondering, you know, where were all the other people that I saw on TV? Because they were definitely not where I was. And so I often say that I've had this, like, because I'm quite an outgoing person, but I didn't have anyone to really share that energy with.
Yeah.
And that was maybe double sad somehow, you know. But then when I got older, we moved again and we moved again. And then, you know, slowly I was starting to find my footing and my friends and my interest. I did a lot of theater in school, where I could stand on a stage, you know, and express myself. That's always what I wanted. But I say that my movies, they come from this place, you know, when we lived out in this very small place. And it's like where the road ends and horizon next, and it's just mountains and sea. And I have this image of myself standing on the outermost point on the island and just screaming into the storm or something, you know, very dramatic. Like, hello, is anyone out there like me? You know, that was my big, like, yearning to find someone who had kind of the same sensibility or hunger for the world or wonder, you know. This, I think I've had a sense of wonder a lot, you know. And so that's where my movies come from. It's kind of me, even the Ugly Stepsister, it's me saying, am I the only one feeling like this?
Yeah. But
surely there must be more people having this experience, you know.
Lovely. At that point, were there any movies that you can remember that were your sort of first loves? We've got the four great loves that we talk about here at the Video Store, which are the movies that have come to you that you've had these relationships with. And the first one is the Puppy Love film. It's often quite innocent and fun, or perhaps it's something that you were a bit too young to have seen. But I'm curious whether there was a movie that stuck with you in that time.
Actually, there were not really any movies in my life at that point, because my parents didn't believe in movies.
What does that mean?
what does that mean? I'm trying to figure out myself, you know, because we didn't own a VHS player. We only had one channel on TV. They were really, you know, they thought we should be, they're really brainy people, my parents.
Okay.
Both teachers, you know, and very, very keen readers. So we were, you know, we had all of the Harry Potter books, and my father read them to us, and so So there was a lot of using your imagination, and I think they thought of movies as like a bit lazy in that way.
Okay, interesting. Okay. That's just as fascinating to not have one.
So we saw MacGyver and stuff on TV after school. We loved MacGyver.
I loved MacGyver too.
Yeah. Are you, it's so cool.
Are you, I was born in 1985. How dare I ask?
1991.
Okay. All right. MacGyver was a big part of my childhood. And I remember sitting in the hairdresser's chair going, give me a MacGyver. And then you sort of later look back on that and you're like, I was asking for a mullet. I was getting a mullet the whole time. I just thought I thought I was cool. But MacGyver is one of those that apparently you should not go back on. Like, if he's a hero in your memory, you should keep him a hero in your memory. Because I think if you were to look at it now and revisit it, it might not be the same.
But then again, you know, one of the elements I always loved about it, it's really camp, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't know what camp was as a kid, but there's something corny about it. It's over dramatic, you know, it's overdone with the action and the emotions and his coolness and, you know, and his tricks of how to get out of the situations are unbelievable, you know, but you want to believe it. And I really like that kind of suspension of disbelief somehow, that you know that it's too much, but that's also what makes it fun. I'm not a realism girl. So I think that's one of the things I really appreciate with MacGyver as well.
Well, just thinking about it now, what I think I loved the most was the fact that he was very practical and that he was resourceful and that he could do it. Like, I also am of the age of the Ninja Turtles. And that was my childhood cartoon. And I loved Donatello because he was the guy that could invent. He was useful. And I think you'd appreciate this. Growing up, when I hit a quote that stuck with me, that I thought, geez, this is it. This is how I can live my whole life kind of quote. It was in a book where the guy said, if you can't make yourself useful to society, it's your fault. It's not society's fault. And I love that. Right. And I've always kind of lived by that, which is like, you've got to be useful. Even if you don't have a job, let's say in a relationship, but you can still give your partner love or attention, or you don't always have to contribute. Or throughout my life, I've always thought, just be useful. But let's get into the film for a bit. What is the Norwegian film industry like for you? What were the biggest contributing factors for you to move from short films into your first feature?
That's a great question. You know, actually, this wasn't supposed to be possible. I've done two film schools in Norway, like one that's, you know, straight out of high school, kind of very practical. And I made a short that was quite successful. And then I moved on to the National Film School after a few years, of rumbling around. And then there I also made an exam or like final thesis project that was quite successful. Usually, you know, I think like out of the six director students at the National Film School, two of them or something statistically make a feature film after 10 years.
Interesting.
So it's quite a hard thing to do. You know, Norway is quite a small country. We, of course, have the Norwegian Film Institute. We should not complain, you know, we have really good grants for artists in Norway and for filmmakers, and there's like development support, but still we are more that want it than can get it somehow, you know.
Okay.
And I got this idea for the film in film school, and most Norwegians, they debut with a low budget feature. We have now like a talent scheme, so for debut films, but where you have a very low budget. So that would say no more than 2 million euros.
Yeah.
And Norway is a very expensive country, so that's not much. But this film that I was developing, you know, it's a... so just to say the pitch of the film, you know, it's a retake of Cinderella. And so it's a retelling of Cinderella following the stepsister, trying to figure out why the stepsister cuts off her toes to try to fit the shoe, which she does in the Brothers Grimm's version of the fairy tale. So that was kind of, that was my idea. That was what I wanted to do. And, but really that means it's a fairy tale. There's body horror. There's, you know, insane costumes. There's locations. There's a ball. There's so many things that are quite expensive. So a lot of people were thinking that I was insane when I put all my money on this one project. So for the last 8 years after I finished school at the Norwegian Film School, it's the only thing I've been working on.
Okay. Where the majority of it was raising money?
No. The majority of it was writing the script. Okay. I'm an trained screenwriter, so I've found people. First, I thought I needed a screenwriter, but then I found people that believed in me and wanted to help me. Like, I have a great script consultant in France called Pierre Hodgson. I work closely with Isabella Eklöf, who wrote and directed Holiday, and wrote Border by Ali Abbasi.
Okay.
So I had great people around me, but it took me a long time. And I knew also that I needed a script that would really, you know, convince the financiers, because I was a debutante, but also a script that was better than the idea somehow, you know, because the idea is very sellable. A lot of people would get excited, but the script needed to be surprising in a way, you know.
Okay.
And then when I had the script, I got the best producer in Norway attached. I knew her a little bit from before, and the script really convinced her. And she said, let's apply. And then...
How were you able to get that relationship? Was that...
That was through... I had been associated with her company for a few years, actually, through a junior producer.
Okay.
So she knew me, and she knew the shorts I'd done. And she knew the project, but the junior producer had left the company, but I knew I wanted it to be produced by her, because she would be the only one with really the muscle to pull it through.
Okay.
So also nice
to have females backing it, because this is very largely a female story, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And her name is Maria Ekerhoved in Merfilm. She now has produced Joachim Trier's newest movie, which is now in the main competition in Cannes this year. And she's been very, very successful for many years. And one of the things that's really her success recipe is that she's very risk-taking. And she knows, and the risk she kind of takes is she knows that for a film within the European co-production, you know, art house system, to have any chance to be successful, you have to you're kind of investing in an artist's point of view.
Yeah.
So she gives so much,
creative freedom,
and she's really just trying to lead you to understand that if you do this, we won't have money for that. But she won't kind of. If that's what you really want to do, okay, then we have to think differently. But she's not one of those producer kind of... Who are making you scared or trying to take over the project. So that was... she's amazing.
How do you survive 8 years trying to make the movie? How do you survive financially? Was there other things that you were doing, or how does it work?
I decided not to do commercials or TV series or anything else, or try to do that. It's not like they're waiting for you when you're finished in school.
Yeah.
It also has to do with, you have to, you know, make your way into those, because I knew that, you know, whatever film production you're doing, it's so much work.
Mm.
And you have to be so invested. And I knew it would take away from the one thing I wanted to do. And actually, I think filmmaking is too hard. So if I'm not very, very passionate, then I can't do it, really.
Yeah.
Then I'd rather do another job. So that's what I've done. I've toured schools in Norway with my short films and or lectures through something called the Cultural School Backpack, which is a state-funded arts program for the schools where they send artists out on to schools with on different tours with a theater piece or whatever, and then
Can
do it with film as well. So I've been driving all of Norway a lot, and then because you're touring, the pay is quite good, so you can actually, you know, work for 2 weeks and then have 2 weeks off. So you'd earn a month in 2 weeks. So that's how I survived.
And then when it comes to the film itself, in a few interviews that I saw online, you spoke about taking a creative nap.
Yeah.
where this... this original idea came to you, right? This is the idea of the shoe and the blood and the stepsister. What is a creative nap? Can you talk through that and what that is as a process for you? I think that's interesting.
Yeah, as I said, I have parents that are very afraid of being lazy. So I'm a very hard worker, and I'm very afraid of being lazy because that's how I've been raised. Yeah, right? But when I realized that having a break or taking a walk, letting something rest, you know, this, the more I've kind of incorporated this into my creative process, the further I can come. Because if you just push and push and push on something in a very logical, work hard state, you can really push yourself into a corner and kind of... tire out exhaust the material somehow or the creativity. And in film school, I was working really hard on my exam thesis, and I got so tired. I'm a kind of I love sleeping. I sleep a long time in the morning, and then I had all these meetings back to back, and I was so tired, and I thought, oh, I'll just lay down for like 10 minutes. Or like 15 minutes, max 20 minutes. So I got a great sofa in my little office, and I started having these like small naps. Actually, you're not really able to fall asleep in that short of time, or at least I'm not. I know people who can, but I can't. And between these meetings, I just had this great experience of. Suddenly, the things that I'd just been talking about, the way I was able to kind of sort them, or suddenly like connections would form in my head in this very easy, non-strained way. Because when you relax your brain like that, things connect in a non-logical way, or like in a more like dream state way, or so you can make connections. You can like jump connections.
Yeah, that's interesting.
In a way you can't in when you're really. And I think walking is a little bit of the same. Like when you walk and you think about something, it's your thoughts can kind of wander. I guess that's the expression for it. That would be the best.
I'm a musician, and for many years doing drumming lessons, my drumming teacher, funny enough, as you're describing it, I can see now what he was doing. If you were trying your best to get this particular kind of rudiment or thing down and you were struggling, then I remember him going, okay, take your mind off it. And you'd go, how the girls, or what's happening at school? And we'd talk about something for 2 minutes, and then he'd say, okay, try now. And then you'd get it. It would fall into place because you knew what you needed to do. That's the difference. Yes. The difference is you know what you need to do, but you don't know how it fits. And then when you can sort of turn off your computer and turn it on again, it all, the paths work. Because someone actually explained that. They're like, we joke in the IT world that have you tried turning it off and on again? And they explain the reasoning behind that. It's not just to give it another try. Pathways in the computer, let's just say your computer's freezing, pathways have journeyed through things and have found corruption, and it's very hard for a computer to work backwards and find a new path. And so the best is to actually turn off and on again so those paths can be refound, and that's why it works. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, now we're going to make this movie. This has been 8 years of writing.
Five.
5 years of writing, and now we're going to make it. When did we start shooting? Because I always love the timelines of these things.
Yeah. So we applied for the first money after just half year after my my producer saw the first draft. We applied for money at the Norwegian Film Institute with a second draft, like half a year later. And usually a lot of people are like standing still in the system for a long time or applying many times. But we flew through the funding system, both in Norway and in Europe. We were granted one of the biggest amounts of money ever in Norwegian film history. And then we got financing from Sweden, Denmark, Poland. We got top funding from the EU system and all of that. So that was insane.
Do you think this is as a result of that incredible producer? What do you think was making this possible?
Yeah, she says it's the script.
Which I'm sure it was in many ways, yeah.
Yeah, I would say it's a combination, you know, of the idea. It's a story that everyone knows.
Yeah.
And then it's a twist on it, which makes people interested. And it's a relatable twist because it's about the character you haven't seen before, but she's relatable. So you kind of start questioning things and all of that. Mm. And then it's like, it's genre, it's a fairy tale. They can see the commercial aspect. Then there's a script that really supports all of that, but also gives it more depth. And, you know, and then it's a great producer who's, you know, well known in the European system. And then there's the debutante. That's me.
Yeah.
And I don't like to toot my own horn, but I've heard that I'm quite charismatic and, you know, quite confident. And I've, in all these years, also writing the script, you know, gotten to know myself better. So I know that I'm very good at collaborating with other people. So I let them in. So even in like the meetings with, if it's like the sales agent, or I'm open to them. It doesn't mean that I will take their feedback and actually use it, but just this opening this space where they feel like, this is someone who's listening and who's
So much of it is playing with the idea, confidence. You know,
being confident but humble somehow, you know.
Yeah.
And then my creative partners, like my editor and my production designer and so on, they said that it was really my director's note that sold the whole thing for them. So, you know, it's a big package of all of these things that I guess we got it right somehow.
Yeah.
And then we had a long pre-production. We got the first money in, I think it was autumn 2022. And then we started shooting February 2024.
Okay.
So it was one and a half year pre-production, which is long.
Yeah.
But it was all about, you know, finding the right locations, finding the people, and there's a lot of prosthetic makeup in this movie, and that takes a long time to, you know, it's, we have this thing saying in film, I'm sure you know it, it's, you know, you can't do it cheap, good, and fast.
Yeah.
You can get two of the three, but you can't do all the three. Yeah. So if you want it cheap and you want it good, you can't do it fast. Okay. I think that's what we kind of went on. We need the time to be able to do this.
At this point, it's worth mentioning, I know, despite not having seen this film, I know that so much of it is practical.
Yeah.
And what was that decision for you? Why did you feel it needed to be practical? Because at this point, in those three, the tripod of filmmaking, as you mentioned, could CGI have helped? Was that something you were considering, or was it just that you always needed or wanted it to be, have these effects be practical?
Yeah, you know, it was, I had a, in the beginning, and I still think, you know, it's a feeling for me, practical versus CGI.
100%.
And you know, all the body horror films or horror films that I love, they're practical. And I think, you know, the classical example is like The Thing versus The Thing 2.
I was literally about to start bringing this up. I watched The Thing for the first time in COVID, in lockdown. Yeah. I had never seen it before. And the guy who I was staying with, my housemate, is actually someone who is a part of the podcast team. And we both agreed that despite that those effects being a little cheesy and a little dated even now, there is a way that it sticks with you unlike any other CGI you've ever seen. It just feels so tangible that despite a little bit of campiness, it resonates. It sticks in your memory.
Yes, exactly. So what I've tried to kind of, when I've tried to put this into words, because I've had to, because, you know, with my collaborators and my producer and so forth, to kind of defend practical over VFX, because there's, or CGI, because there's this idea that CGI will be more or less expensive, but really you're pushing that to the, that's the last thing you do on the film, and suddenly it costs so much more. That's what happened with the little VFX stuff where we did, you know, it ended up costing much more than we thought.
Interesting.
So, but the way I tried to tell, you know, there's this thing. I also got to work with great VFX and prosthetic makeup people, all working with Lars von Trier. And the VFX supervisor of Trier, he said, I will always do it practical first if I can, because the practical nature, you know, gives away so much of how things would actually look. And also, although it's like puppeteered and stuff, maybe it will look a bit cheesy and wanky or like weird, but actually that those mistakes, that's actually what makes it feel real.
Yeah.
Because CGI is actually too perfect somehow.
Yeah, yeah, no,
you don't
totally
have all of those misunderstandings and difficulties and whatever, you know, that lead it to look, because the world is chaotic. Mm. Reality is chaotic. And I guess practical gives it some of that chaoticness. And then there's like just the effect being in a room with gravity, you know, and being in the room with the actors. And so you actually believe it. It becomes tactile.
Sure.
No,
they're not acting to a tennis ball.
No, exactly.
It's real. Yeah.
And okay. Then there's this last thing that I think is really interesting, and it's just an idea I have. But you know, the campiness or this feeling that you can kind of see that it's an effect.
Yeah.
But it's but because you're so far into them. Into the fiction, so it's a suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
But this actually allows you to look at it and enjoy it more than if it had looked, even if it looked too good somehow.
No, sure.
Because then you can't say, oh, is it real, is it not? Of course, this, so, I guess with all effects, this is like a thing that the audience is really like, playing in their mind. Is it real, or how did they, you know, somewhere in the back of the mind? And I really like it when you can, where the audience understands, oh, it is an effect, but they choose to believe it somehow. Because then you can really enjoy it and enjoy the craftsmanship of it, you know. I made the color also a different the blood a different color, because I didn't want it to be too real, because then it's just too disgusting.
Yeah.
Then you can't really lean into it. And, you know, there's like this game in it that I really enjoy.
Oh, I can't wait to actually watch this movie, because what you're privy to in the trailer is the fact that she's now going to get her nose broken, which, you know, even in 2025 is a pretty big deal in terms of a surgery and pain and soreness. So, you know, centuries ago, this, where you've got this hammer and a chisel, I can only imagine how brutal that moment's going to be. Did was there more that even came out in the shooting that was even more gorier than what was on the script? Did you take things further, or did you kind of pretty much stick to the script in that sense? Like, yeah, what was it like for you to see that gore in real life?
Yeah, first of all, you know, when you have practical effects, you have to really stick to the plan, because, you know, you made that foot to be looked at from the left. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, it's like, totally.
The less you make of that thing, the less money you have to spend on it. So you really have to stick to your idea, or within that frame you've kind of made for
yourself. That makes sense. Yeah.
So I storyboarded the scenes very early on, and that was so much fun. And I think that storyboarding, we only storyboarded the scenes that really needed to, like dance sequences and body horror scenes and the intimate scenes, and they're really my favorites. So I will for sure storyboard so much more in the future. And then on set, you know, we only had 28 days shooting this. It's not as much body horror as the substance, but we have like animals and dresses and a lot of prosthetic makeup when there's no body horror as well, and the ball and all of that. The substance had 100 days of shooting,
A
month with just the effects. And we had like one day in Copenhagen to pick up some toes. Didn't have time on the shooting. So, you know, on set, it was really, you know, we had one day for each of the big body horror scenes, and we had to, you know, the shots went flying here and there. We didn't get everything we thought home. But it's so technical. But really, you know, I also have a really, really good actress, and I think she's everything. And she really sells it, you know, that you believe that this is happening to her body. It's just a lot of fun. And I think I still haven't really understood how yucky it really is, because, you know, I love body horror. But because I'm in control of these scenes, because I know what will happen, they don't really, you know, come out of nowhere. But I can, you know, intellectually understand that I've really pulled some out of the bag. But that was really, you know, I needed it to be really body horroring, these body horror scenes. You know, I only have a few of them because that's what we could afford, both money-wise and time-wise. But I needed them to really go there. You know, my worst nightmare was to disappoint the other gore enthusiasts like myself. So.
Well, lovely. You've touched on the substance. I'm curious to know, along the making of your film, how did that timeline work in amongst the substance? Because
We were just starting to edit when the substance was in Cannes.
Okay.
And then, I saw it like at the end of my edit or something. Yeah.
Okay. So I love the fact that. Everything about what you were doing was on its own, and that it wasn't necessarily informed.
Not at all.
Yeah, exactly. And so it just shows that oftentimes there are just some things in the water.
Exactly.
Where we finally have more female voices in filmmaking, whether it's in the tip of Norway or, across Europe. And that these stories are getting made, where we're starting to get more and more perspective of what it means to be, perhaps you can just speak on that, because I'm a male here, but to be able to tell the story of beauty standards from the perspective of a female filmmaker.
Absolutely.
You just feel it in the water, right? It's like
yeah, and I think it's like a mini wave of like feministic body horror. I think it really started with Julia Ducournau and Raw. I saw that in 2015, right, 16 when it came, when I was in film school, and that was really informed me and my filmmaking. And I had just also in film school, fallen deeply in love with Cronenberg. And yeah. I think when I saw Dr. No's movie, it just made so much sense that, of course, I can do that genre. Or, you know, or of course, yeah. that genre is also for me. For as and I think, you know, there's so much rage in her movies when it comes to, you know, the female existence.
Yeah.
And I think I share that rage. And it was just such a gruesome, fun watch with Raw in the cinemas.
I've heard yeah. of Raw, but we call it the back of the box here at the video store, which is this the sort of synopsis. What's the back of the box on Raw again? She becomes a cannibal, right?
Yeah, she becomes a cannibal. So it's the younger sister of two who she's a vegetarian. Or vegan even, I think. Yeah. And she starts in veterinary school where her sister is already there. And they have this insane welcome ritual at this veterinary school. Like, I mean, insane.
Yeah.
It's like...
What country was this made in?
It's French. Okay. It's French. It was screened in, I think it was on Sainte-Anne Regarde or one of the side programs, at least in Cannes. And... and then she's forced to eat a rabbit liver at this by her sister, I think. And then she suddenly gets a very, very big craving for meat.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there's an iconic scene the first time she eats a human flesh involving a finger and some... Actually, the waxing of the downstairs. Okay.
Lovely.
It's an insane movie.
I just I love at this point acknowledging to you that you've joined, you know, you've created something that sits amongst these now.
Oh, you know, that's amazing.
You know, yeah. I always love the idea, and what I've always loved is the practical publishing of something, whether it's an album or even my sort of short films at film school. I left film school to go, let's start a cinema. So I never went further than my short films at Varsity. I realized we needed a place for this in Johannesburg. But I love the practicalness of knowing that you've made this film. And I just love the fact that in amongst all your inspirations, you've got your film that now sits amongst it, which is so delightful.
Can I just tell you a very little, a short story about that?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was invited to the Criterion Closet in New York when I was there.
Oh, cool.
Now.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, I was so honored. You know, talking about being amongst what you are inspired by, you know, or aspire to be. And they told me David Cronenberg would be there like 5 days later.
Yeah.
And I was like, why do I have to leave? I want to be here when he is here. But anyways, I left post-it on. They took my photo in there, just like a, and then I left a little post-it with a note for David Cronenberg.
That's lovely.
Just thanking him for his art. And I was told that he had seen it when he was there and that he really enjoyed it. So that's lovely. You know. That's amazing.
That closet, that Criterion Closet, is a little bit like the tiny desk, but for musicians.
Yes.
It's like
if you get invited
to do that, it's very exciting.
That's very exciting.
What have some of the other festival highlights been for you? Because there was Sundance, there was Berlin. Where were some of these, like, pinch me moments?
Ooh. You know, the film was done 10 days before Sundance. And I was next level exhausted, you know, because I'd been really rushing to the finish line and worked so hard for so long. And I was scared shitless and had no distance to the movie, you know.
Yeah.
I was really harsh with myself that screening in Sundance. And but there was a spontaneous applaud towards the end.
Okay.
And that was you know, thrilling. And but I kept it all at a distance. And then when I went to Berlin, I was able to enjoy it a little bit more. But I was also really nervous there because there was many people from that had been a part of the film that were there, and And I was sure, you know, that the Sundance audience, you know, they're quite nerdy in the way that, you know, it's the midnight screening audience in Sundance. It's like a very specific kind of people. Okay. And Berlin necessarily doesn't do that much of a genre. But then I got the same spontaneous applaud at the same place in Berlin.
This is at a point in the movie. So not the applause at the end. This is like there's a moment where you just instinctively want to give an applause.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Lovely. Yes. Or at least, you know, these are premiere screenings, so people are, I guess, a little bit extra excited. Yeah. But now I have this feeling that although the audience hasn't done that again, you know, at the other screenings, that this is at least, I wanted it to be a cathartic moment, and I think I succeeded with that. And I went to the U.S. to film festival now in April, a horror film festival in New Orleans called the Overlook Film Festival.
Oh, cool.
And there the film won the audience award.
Oh,
and
that was always the best.
Yeah, everything.
Okay, that's amazing. Okay, now your film is getting the screening in Johannesburg or in South Africa, which is exciting. What's more on the horizon for this? What more can you look forward to with Ugly Stepsister? Where's your head at now? I mean, are you still very much in the promotion of it? Are you even starting
really
to think about something else?
Yeah, I'm really trying to get out of it because it's too much. I need a break. You know, it's been so intense, and I really haven't like had a moment to look back and say, oh, I did that, you know, because I'm just like running. You know, success is weird because you dream of it and you really fight for it. But when you have it, it's hard to enjoy it, right?
Sure.
Because it's a lot of work and a lot of pressure. But it's been insane, you know, with Sundance and Berlinale, and then, you know, the film is sold nearly worldwide.
Yeah.
It's opening in Indonesia this week. You know, it's going to Cambodia, Laos, and South Africa, and South America, and Middle East. You know, it's insane. So I'm just enjoying that a lot. You know, checking Letterboxd also a little bit is fun.
It's
to hear the audience reviews. And really, you know, they're picking up on all these different details, and that's just such a gift as a filmmaker to get the audience's response in that way. So I'm actually, you know, now I just want to let it out into the world. You know, I look upon it as it's like a teenage daughter. You know, she's been living home. I've been raising her. And you know, I'm so ready for her to leave the nest.
Okay.
But at the same time, I don't know what my life will be.
Yeah.
But she's doing. I was just hoping that she would get some friends. And I think really she's finding her crowd, and she will spread her wings and do her own thing. You know, she doesn't need her mother to follow her everywhere.
Yeah, if you raised her right and taught her right from wrong, and yeah, then she'll go and be an incredible adult. So it's like you've put so much
full on, you know. She's not for everyone, but
Oh, I love that. I love that idea of her being this teenage daughter.
I could talk about that analogy for a long time.
No, I totally get that. I mean, okay, so then let's talk about any other kids that you want you need to raise now. Any other ones on the?
Yeah, I'm pregnant with twins.
Okay. At the same time.
At the same time.
Okay.
Yeah, with two different fathers. No, I'm just kidding. It's two different producers. So.
Lovely.
I have two different projects, and I'm really, they're quite different from this one, because I'm, as a filmmaker, I'm always story first, and then the form will follow, story and form, that's really what excites me, when I can find those two that work together somehow. But I'm not, a lot of people ask me if I'm going to do, you know, only body horror, if that's my thing, you know, am I a genre queen, and I don't think I am necessarily. You know, I see it. I see genre as tools of filmmaking. You know, if it's right for the story, it's right for the story. But so actually, I'm doing one historic 1920s piece in Norway.
Okay.
And then I have a near future pop factory in Eastern Europe. So it's the scope's quite big.
A pop factory.
In Korea, they have pop factories now for K-pop. So it's where you get young kids to enroll in these. They call it factories, but it's like it's not schools because
An academy would be a nicer word.
Yeah, academy.
Factory is a. Is
but they call it factory.
I know. That's so crazy.
That's the idea behind that. But you know, whatever I do, it will have an element of camp, always some humor. But you know, I always start from a very deep sympathy for the main character that I feel. Oh my God! I said in the beginning, this is a part of me that I can really relate to, and I'm not. And I don't feel people have really touched upon that, maybe. Yeah. And let me send it out into the world and hear if someone else can relate somehow, you know.
It's lovely, man.
And if I can put some, I like to shock the audience or at least like show them stuff that they weren't sure they were going to see. A lot of people on Letterboxd are really into my erect penises. There's two of them.
Okay, cool. That's something to look forward to.
That's something to look forward to. You know, they're not on screen for that long, but and I wasn't expecting people to go so off on it, but I really love to show stuff that people are maybe longing to see. I think somehow with more explicit sex and stuff. I think you know we want to see it. We want to see something that's real, that's something that's not censored or that's scared of showing you something. You know?
Yeah, no, we actually talk about that, funny enough, at the video store a lot. And there's one guy who works here called Perrin. And we've often spoken about the exposed male genitalia in films and how it's funny how that just, it is, it's a little bit like a car crash. It's sort of, it's like, oh, we don't see this. You know, we've been shown so many little moments of, you know, female breasts, but the moment you see a penis, it's like, oh, this is wild.
Yeah, I also have a very quite full on shot of a female genitalia as well. So you know, I'm quite. I'm a feminist, you know.
Sure.
You have to be
equal. No, but it's just as you said. It is just showing an audience something that they haven't seen, and that's been one of the loveliest gifts of cinema for me, and especially being able to screen these movies at the Bioscope when we screened Into the Void, you know, and you're like, you're gonna see something that you've never seen before. And it's gonna be on a big screen. You're gonna leave this changed. So thanks for that, and thanks for giving us something more that we haven't seen. Perhaps a last little note. We've got a film that we talk about here at the video store, which is the film that you could settle down with. It's the film that you could marry. It's a film that you could keep coming back to. I'm curious whether you've got it like an all-time favorite. That could be
so
a. It is. It's one of those that you can sort of instinctively feel is kind of always there for you to enjoy.
I actually don't revisit films that often because I feel I haven't seen enough at all. You know,
there's not enough time.
And I became a mother 5 years ago in the middle of all of this. So, you know, time is scarce. But well, what would it be? You know, I have a few that live vividly in my head and that I just, and you know, I can pop in anywhere in that movie and enjoy myself, but in my head.
Yeah.
So I think it would be my puppy love, as you called it?
Yeah.
So when we finally got a DVD player and VHS player when I was 13, I discovered Amelie.
That's one of mine.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And anywhere in that movie, you know, it's just so comforting. I think, you know, someone told me it's like the last pure movie because it came out right before 9/11. And after that, no one can make a movie that is that kind of hopeful and whimsical and without that darkness. And
what an interesting way to look at the world. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then after that, I would say Beau Travail by Claire Denis.
Okay.
That's really, you know, I can spend anywhere in my head. And then I have a whole kind of place for Cronenberg. So okay. It's like The Fly, Existence, Dead Ringer, Videodrome, Crash. Mm. You know, they're all, I can enjoy that a lot.
Lovely. What have you enjoyed recently? We have, you know, one of the ways in which you've visited the Bioscope, in specifically the video store now, is that perhaps there's something you can return to the video store.
Yes.
What have you watched recently that you've enjoyed? Could be something on TV, or it could be a movie or something at a festival.
That's the worst thing with having a movie in the festival, is that you don't get to see any.
Sure. No, I'd imagine if you're participating, you're spending all your time in meetings.
I saw an amazing movie at the film festival in Tromsø in Northern Norway in January. And that was Afternoons of Solitude.
Okay.
By Abel Ferreira, I think it's called. Abel Ferreira? No.
Okay.
Yeah. But Afternoons of Solitude, anyways, it's a documentary about bullfighting, and it's so good.
Okay.
It's so good.
Okay.
And then I would like to return Alice in the Cities by Wim Wenders.
Okay.
One of his first ones, and it's very, very beautiful. Very, very good. And then The Sweet East by Sean Price Williams that I saw in the cinema last summer.
Okay. Lovely. Yeah. Thank you. Listen, I really appreciate your time. I think it is such an honor to have caught you at this moment, this exciting moment in your life. And it's going to be so lovely to see, you know, the next set of kids and just everything that'll happen. And I just wish you the best in all of that. And just know that if you ever do find yourself on the continent of Africa again or anywhere near Joburg, please come and visit us and reach out know that you've got this little cinematic home for you here in Joburg.
You know, that's what's so great with movies, that movie lovers and nerds will connect, you know, wherever we're in the world, there's so much connecting, and I love that.
I think you would probably be very similar to me, which is that if you're in a foreign country, you go and visit the cinemas, you watch movies there.
Absolutely.
So we're a cinema you can come and visit. But thank you, Emily. Thank you for the time, and
thank you.
All the best with everything. Huh?
Thank you. Thanks for a great chat.
Lovely. All right. What a great chat. I really enjoyed that. And I loved, to be honest, how easy it was to talk with her, especially when it is something over Zoom or Google Meets in this case. I enjoy when the guest is in the room right in front of me. I can feed off their energy, and sometimes it can be a little tricky to have these conversations with, you know, internet lagging and connection issues potentially. But it was just, I think, a testament to her personality, which she even mentions, is this kind of outgoing personality that it made a conversation like this just so fun and so effortless. As we said, The Ugly Stepsister is in cinemas around the country in the week that this episode is coming out. So please go and give it a watch. I, as I said when we had this chat, hadn't had a chance to watch the movie yet. I still haven't had a chance, and that is because Perrin, who works behind the counter here, alongside us, took the only copy for the weekend. I joke. I when the film unlocked at the Bioscope on Friday, I had to go travel to Cape Town for the weekend. I also play in a band called Short Straw, and we had a series of shows over the weekend. So I still haven't had a chance to watch this. So let's hope, actually any minute now, Perrin could come back and he could bring back this copy for me to watch. And it'll be great to actually sink my teeth into this film. I'm very excited to watch it. Here he is. Finally.
How's it, guys? I'm returning my copy of The Ugly Stepsister to the store. Sorry, it was the only copy, so I left Russ hanging for the weekend. But now it's back. And Russ, lucky for you, it's on the shelf, but it's also showing in the bioscope. So you could maybe go check it out there. But what I want to say is it's a great little movie. A lot of people are comparing it to The Substance. It's not as gross as The Substance, but it's just as important in terms of its messaging. And what The Ugly Stepsister is about is it is the Cinderella story told through the perspective of the evil stepsister, or quote-unquote evil stepsister, ugly stepsister. And yeah, but don't think the Cinderella telling of the Disney telling of Cinderella. It's the it's more the Brothers Grimm. So it's the darker, more gruesome, heavier thematic version of that story. And the film gets gross. It gets really gruesome. It's not as gross as The Substance, but it's still quite gross, and horror heads who love gore will appreciate it. But there were moments that really made me flinch quite a bit. But anyways, great little movie about impossible beauty standards for women to adhere to. And it just goes to show how that story is still pertinent to today's society, like The Substance, where these women are breaking themselves to be, quote unquote, this perfect vision of beauty of what society regards as beautiful. And with The Ugly Stepsister, because it's told through that person's perspective, she's seeing what people regard as beautiful through Cinderella, and she's being told that she's not beautiful. So she has to go through this process of breaking herself to be this beautiful thing, to try win the heart of the prince, who's a bit of a dick in the movie. And yeah, it's just a really tragic telling of that. And it's also really funny as well. It's a sharp satire on beauty, like The Substance. And yeah, it's just really, really great. And it's just another fun example, like The Substance, of it's telling us to be kinder to ourselves, to be more loving of ourselves, to accept who we are. And that's what The Ugly Stepsister does really well as well. It's a great coming-of-age story because of that. And yeah, it's a great little Norwegian horror film that I'm so happy is going to be showing in South Africa, which is really, really cool. We don't often get foreign horror films like that. So, yay, love it.
Okay, thanks, bud. Appreciate it. Appreciate getting the copy back. But yeah, we have enjoyed having lots of chats with directors. Off the top of my head, I can think of a really great episode being with someone like Samantha Knell, which also was great to talk about, like, a female voice in directing. Someone like Mandla Dube was a really great chat. All of this is in our home base, which is the videostore.co.za, where we've got links to all our or to many of our previous guest episodes. And so we love having the directors on. Fausto Bacatti was a good director to talk to. Yeah, there's many. So yeah, go have a listen to one of the old ones. But yeah, that's the home base. It's the videostore.co.za. And as we said, Ugly Stepsister is in cinemas, including the Bioscope. Go out and enjoy it. All right. Thank you for listening, and thank you for wandering in this week. We will see you again next week. Bye-bye.